welcome. It is Your Money, and it's always a fun show when we say ask Bruce and Peg anything. Once again, let's welcome to the program the founder of Wealth Enhancement, Bruce Helmer, and financial advisor, and senior vice president and financial advisor, Peg Webb. Hello to both of you. Hopefully you're making it through this holiday season well enough.
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Peg. Good morning, Susie Jones. Good morning, listeners. Yeah, thank you, Susie. Again, I'm always stunned at this time of year how fast time seems to go and how quickly we got here. It's enjoyable, but it's busy and it's hectic. And I'm sure it's hectic for listeners also, but great day to get your financial question asked and answered, hopefully. We'll take any financial questions throughout the show. Peg, I thought I would get us rolling a little bit. I had a couple things happen during the week that are definitely related, and it occurred to me that I get this question or variations of this question frequently. I want to pose it to you and see how often you hear it and see and get your insights. But the question revolves around highly compensated people and saving for retirement. Are they better off using a plan like their company, say 401k or their company retirement plan, where they get a deduction for the contribution, they can make the contribution with pre-tax dollars, or should they use the Roth part of their plan, or both? And then that also leads into, if you're highly compensated or you're in a high tax bracket, when or if does it make sense to do Roth conversions and to move tax-deferred money into tax-advantaged money, but you have to pay the taxes in order to do that? The variations of that concept I had hit me in the last week, I think, three or four times, and I realized I actually get variations of that a lot. How do you address that, and are you getting that question a lot also?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, there's just so much detail to this and how it kind of intertwines in your family tax return in any given year. So let's take 2025. So 2025, you're a worker bee and you can decide, do I want to contribute to my 401k? Well, you absolutely want to contribute to the point where the corporation is going to match you some of their dollars, dollar for dollar. So you'd be crazy not to. But a lot of our clients take advantage of doing a 401k and an IRA if they can. So let me just give you some details here. In 2025, if you were under 50 years old, you could put $23,500 in your 401k. And the employer usually just takes that right out of your paycheck, and it's kind of hiding money from yourself. By the way, next year, 2026, it's raised $1,000, so it'll be $24,500. But then we had this, and this is longer ago, Bruce, when they said, oh, if you're 50 or older, you need to probably do some catch up, because the dollar amounts that they would allow us to put in were a lot smaller than they are today. So 50-year-olds in 2025 could put in $31,000, and actually next year they could put in $32,500. Now that's work plans, but then you have this IRA that you can choose to invest in, and that goes by how much income, you know, are you a high income earner? So if you're a single filer, you could still do an IRA if you have $161,000 between $175,000. So, I mean, that's a high dollar amount, but you could contribute $7,000 and then the IRS is going to raise it $500 next year. Then there's often talk about, you know, that's married filing jointly, then you could have $240,000, et cetera. But what you want to do is see if you can contribute to these. And then the harder question is, do you want it to be tax deferred, where you don't pay any tax now and you get a deduction? Or do you want to contribute to a Roth, which is after tax money that then grows tax free for the future? And these are big decisions for people, because most people, they do not want to pay more taxes than they have to. Even though they're looking out to their future, their immediate, their immediate wishes and wants is, I want that tax deduction. So what we try to do is get people to balance with tax deferred, tax advantaged, and taxable money. Those are our three buckets of money. And it's important that you work with your financial advisor or you do a lot of research, because the big decision and probably the most important decision of doing it now is one day you're going to retire and you're going to want to live off these buckets of money. And what if you had all of your money in tax deferred? And believe me, Bruce, you know this. People that come to see us have a high percentage of IOU to the IRS because they deferred everything. So I'm a favor of Roth, and I'm a big favor of deferring, but not all of one type. And we witness that on the back end in helping people create a paycheck for the rest of their lives. Bruce?
Yeah, and again, Peg, that was a great answer. We talk about what we call tax diversification. Most listeners understand diversification in terms of asset allocation. We want stocks, we want bonds, we want real estate, we want precious metals. They understand that, but a lot of people don't have tax diversification. And I've told the story on this show before. I met with someone earlier this year that retired from our industry, and they had a big IRA, and that was virtually all the money they had. And I'm like, what are you doing here? How can I help you? You were in our business. And she's like, I'm getting killed in taxes. The required minimum distribution on my IRA throws me right into the 24% tax bracket, and I'm wondering what I can do. And I'm like, well, at this point, there's nothing, but you should have done your tax planning and looked for tax diversification 10 and 20 years ago. It's probably too late now. So Peg, the kind of the follow-up then to that whole concept is, sometimes when we look at Roth conversion, people that are overweighted in tax-deferred accounts and trying to create tax diversification and get some into Roth or tax-advantaged accounts where they might avoid the taxes altogether, oftentimes we see that they're in a high tax bracket, so we say the conversion doesn't make sense. But then the question comes up, but I'm never going to be in a lower tax bracket than this. I'm always going to have a lot of income putting me in a high bracket. Even if I'm paying, you know, at a 22 or 24% bracket, might a conversion still not make sense just to get that tax diversification that you're talking about?
Yeah, and before I answer that, this is such a big deal, I think, is starting in 2026, a high earner, and they call high earners $150,000 or more, it's mandated that you put your catch-up contributions into a Roth. So now the government is actually kind of forcing us to do this after-tax bucket, which we have never seen before, right? We always had a choice. And so that's a big deal. So Roth conversions, I absolutely love Roth conversions. If I can convince people to take some of that tax deferred and create tax-free money, you know, down the road, yes, it is so painful to pay tax ahead of time of when you really thought you, you know, would make more money on that money, just letting it compound. But one day you have to pay the piper. So there's circumstances, Bruce, where, you know, how we dive into people's tax returns and say, oh, I think you've got $5,000 or $10,000 that we could convert to a Roth, and it wouldn't be that painful. Like, you're just soaking up some of those lower tax brackets. Just to kind of make it a quick response here, Bruce, is I think there's 60 or 70% of people that could be doing Roth conversions, and they either are not educated about how to do them, they don't know whether the positives or negatives, what they actually are. So I highly recommend, if you have a lot of tax deferred, that you either work with your financial advisor or you ask questions with your CPA, but you have to do it before the year ends, right? So we're coming up on December 31st. You have to do it for this tax year now. Bruce?
Yeah, and just to put a exclamation point, I guess, on the topic, there have been cases, Peg, and it's not uncommon at all, where somebody might be in a 22% bracket, and we will still recommend doing some conversion. And again, listeners have heard us use this phrase before, to soak up the bracket that they're going to be in anyway. We might say, okay, we can convert $10,000 before we bump into the 24% bracket. So let's convert $10,000 this year. We'll look at it again next year, but at least we start to shift some money into tax advantage where there won't be, you know, a tax lien on that money. And at the end of the day, and you're right, Peg, people don't want short-term pain. They want immediate gratification. And a lot of times they don't want to pay more taxes today than they have to. But sometimes I can demonstrate, look, you're going to pay more in the short term than you would have to, but it's going to save you a lot in the future, and you're going to pay less net taxes over your lifetime if you pay a little bit more now than you don't have to pay a lot later. So it's just a question of pay me now or pay me later, and when are you going to have to pay more? And we can do that kind of forecasting and planning, and you're right. Most people don't know how to do that by themselves. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we can be value added. Susie, we absolutely want to get listeners involved, but I have one more I wanted to hit on today, Peg. The other one that's come up a lot for me recently, people that are of a certain age, 40s, 50s, whatever, and they think they didn't start soon enough, and they come to see me and they go, oh my gosh, I should have done this 10 years ago. I'm late to the party. Is it too late for me? I really feel stressed. I want to retire at whatever age, 62, 65, and I'm already 45 or 50. What do I do? What do you tell those people that think they may have missed the boat, or they made some poor choices, or they waited too long and they haven't saved enough, and now they're feeling stressed?
Yeah, you know what's interesting, Bruce, is, and we've done this for decades, I would summarize the fact that when I first got into this business and I was helping people, you know, starting to build retirement, 40-year-olds, I didn't have any 40-year-olds wondering what they should be doing. And it's just a total shift now where the younger people, and I feel like it's because of all the knowledge you can get on the internet and you're probably talking about money more. With people that originally I would say we'd have people maybe 10 years from retirement coming to see us. And now there's a lot of these 40-year-olds that want help in trying to build their wealth. And sometimes, Bruce, it's because they don't want to work till they're 65. They're trying to figure out, could I retire at 52? And I think there's a high percentage of those people. So what do we do? You know, we try to get our arms around the situation that's at hand right away. And just if you're so motivated to be able to retire early, then you probably have to have some pain before you get to that age. So let's take 52. So let's say that a 40-year-old says, I want to retire at 52. Well, you have to really dive into, what are you spending your money on? Are these things important to you now when you look at the future and you could have the ability to say, I can actually financially retire? That's huge, you know, and become educated on, you know, not carrying credit card balances. Now, usually people who are asking us about retiring early don't have big high numbers on a credit card and paying, you know, interest on that. But also what I witness is, you know, you may be just starting your family at 40. This is kind of a newer phenomenon, right? I had my kids very young, but kids are actually, young people are saying, you know what, we'll have our first child at 38 years old. So, there's some cost, you know, that you need to realize that there's cost in having kids and having them go through college and all of that. So, one of the things that we do is we walk through this list of things that, you know, here's some probabilities for you to be able to retire earlier. And maybe you do, maybe you don't. But lastly, I'll tell you, and I said this on the show many times, my goal was at 55 to be able to do what I wanted to do. And I was, an inspiration for me was I would see people at the end of their driveway selling vegetables and flowers, and I'd be driving to work, and I go, that looks so peaceful. That I want a target for that. Well, I got to 55 and I said, well, I'm not doing that and I'm still working today. So it's all in, do you love it? And that's where I think financial advisors can come, as a real value, is to be able to talk to someone like us, that the steps that you need to do, early at 40 years old, Bruce.
So the bottom line is it's never too late. I mean, starting earlier is better than starting later, but it's never too late. And like you said, Peg, the fact that people in their 40s now are thinking about this, I agree with you. Earlier in my career, we never saw anybody in their 30s or 40s. 50 seemed to be the magic age where people would wake up and have an epiphany moment and go, oh my gosh, I'm 50. Where did the time go? How did this happen? And I haven't thought about when I want to retire or my financial future or what it looks like. Now, I keep hijacking our own show because I promise that we'll get listeners involved, but that made me think of something else, Peg. You talked a lot in your answer about the amount of clients that we get that do want to retire early, that want to retire at 55 or 60 or 62. Talk a little bit about some of the pros and cons or some of the planning challenges or opportunities of early retirement. Because the first thing that comes to mind for me is, okay, you're not eligible for Medicare until you're 65. So one of the things you have to think about is how are you going to cover your health insurance costs if you retire early until you're Medicare eligible? But there's other things to consider about retiring early also.
Yeah, I think you have to, so how do I say this? You almost have to have a bogey of a number, you know, that's out there that you feel like you could achieve. And, you know, they talk a little bit about this rule of 25. And what that means is, let's say you have expenses of $6,000 a month, and that's $72,000 a year, that you need to multiply that number by 25, and then you would need $1.8 million. I think that's a bunch of crap, really. It's just...
Wow.
No, it's real. That math...
You can't think crap on Sunday morning?
I did. I want to be dramatic. It's not that easy. It's not that easy just to do that math and say, oh, well, now I've got this $1.8 million. What if that $1.8 million is all in tax deferred? You don't really have $1.8 million. You have an IOU to the IRS. And that's probably the biggest point that I have made in my career with people is that's not really all your money. You still owe the IRS. So let's not think $1.8 million is enough when 40% of it has to go to the government. So I did want to be really dramatic there too. And then if you want to retire before 65 is that magic Medicare age, then you have to really put some dollars away because you're going to have to live off your money before some of these things kick in. And then the big, big question is, when do I start Social Security? I still think there's a lot of confusion as to, you know, 62, full retirement age, 70 years old, what's the best for me? And you can't just say what's the best for me because a lot of people are joint, they're partners. And it actually affects that person's Social Security on when you take Social Security. So that's the complexity there too. But if you want to do that, you're going to have to be doing goal setting. You know, driving for a certain number is great, but it has to be the net number outside of the IRS. I highly recommend, you know, getting help if you want to retire early or get all your ducks in a row ahead of time. Bruce?
Yeah, all the three questions we talked about so far, and again, I hijacked the show, but I think those are things that a lot of people are thinking about, so I think we covered stuff that a lot of people maybe wonder about or have questions about. And all three of those topics, including the one you just brought up, big Social Security, we can do an entire show on all those topics, and we probably will in the future. The Social Security thing, we do a show on that a couple times a year just because it's so important and more complicated than people think it is. Susie, I think we've got time to get one in from the listeners before we have to take a break.
Yeah, this is a good one at 651-461-9226. If you and your partner of 21 years are not legally married, are you filing taxes? Can we file jointly or only as single files?
Oh, wow. Peg, so I understand marriage. If you're married, you have a choice. You can still file individually or you can file married jointly. But does the law allow for cohabitation or partners or whatever but that aren't legally married? I don't think they can file a joint return, can they?
I don't think so. I've not seen it where they can unless there's something that recently changed. I think you have to do individual.
All right. Very good. How about this one? Love your show. Could you talk about the difficulty of Roth conversion as a single taxpayer? That's from Sue in Plymouth, and we have 1 minute.
Yeah, Sue in Plymouth. Peg, we probably have to defer. That's a longer answer than we have time for. But when we come back, we'll answer Sue's question, and I promise I won't keep hijacking the show, and we'll let listeners ask the questions of Peg, not me.
Okay. 651-461-9226. That is the number to call if you have a question for Bruce or Peg. And remember, it's Ask Bruce and Peg Anything. So whatever is on your mind financially, we encourage you to jump in and be a part of your show. We love phone calls too. So if you're listening and you're somewhere safe and you can call this number, 651-461-9226, you can jump right on the air with Bruce and Peg and they'll get your question answered. 651-461-9226. And welcome back. It is the second half of Your Money. Once again, Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement with us, and Peg Webb, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor. And it is a segment we call Ask Bruce and Peg Anything. We have caller and we have questions. So you tell me, Bruce, what would you like to do first? You want to take our caller?
Sure, let's do that.
All right, Dennis is on the line from Cottage Grove. Dennis, go ahead. You are on with Bruce and Peg.
Yeah, my main question is about the extra $6,000 deduction this year on taxes, part of the big, beautiful bill. My understanding is that for filing jointly, have to be below $150,000 modified adjusted gross income. What deductions are added back into the adjusted gross income to get to that modified adjusted gross income? For me, it mainly applies to what of Social Security would be added back in. So in general, what are the deductions added back in to get to that modified adjusted gross income?
Hey, Dennis, thanks for listening, and thanks for really a very good question with a couple different components to it, Peg. So I hope you know the specifics because I don't, but let me kind of give context or set the stage. So what Dennis is asking about, this was really marketed as a way of you not having to pay taxes on your Social Security, which is not actually true, but there's a credit. If our income is below a certain level, we can get this $6,000 credit to help offset the taxes that we pay on our Social Security benefit. But it's based on, as Dennis said, modified adjusted gross income. And what the heck does that mean? What does modified adjusted gross income mean, Peg?
Well, so this is actually called the senior bonus deduction. And if you're 65-year-old, and older, you get this deduction. And Bruce, you're right in that it was it was a way of, hey, we can't not tax your Social Security, but we're going to give these bonuses in 2025 through 2028. And it was $6,000 a person. So the deduction phases out. I have this cheat sheet because Wealth Enhancement Group, thank you for creating these cheat sheets for us. But the deduction phases out for incomes above $150,000 married filing jointly or $75,000 single. A deduction is eliminated for incomes above $250,000 married filing jointly and $175,000 single. So the fact that you're getting this, is that going to affect your Social Security or trickle on as extra income? And it comes into play not only on how much your Social Security is taxed, but also we just talked about these Roth conversions. We were talking about it all, do this and create income on your income tax now. I think it's more complex than ever to see if that's of value to you to create more income. Now, you're going to want to take this deduction, and it actually, for a lot of people, might help them get in a lower situation where they could take advantage of not getting as much paid on their Social Security and all these other ripples. Like, Social Security has that extra tax, you know, that you have to pay if you are taking Medicare. And so Medicare is actually saying, okay, you have to send in $185, you know, a month because you're of your income. Or if you're making $500,000 a month, you have to send in $6,000, or, you know, dramatic things like that. So the tax return is such a ripple. So here's the bottom line. I am such a believer in people doing their tax return before the year ends. And Wealth Enhancement Group does a lot of that, where we're anticipating and trying to figure out how can we maximize this tax return before it gets to the end of the year. Now we're kind of at the end here, but that's probably the best way you'll know what you should and shouldn't do. Bruce?
Yeah, and again, I, to Dennis's, to the specific part of the question, you know, a gross income is pretty easy to understand. It's all the income you have, all the income from a paycheck, all the income that you, 1099s you get from investments, if you take withdrawals of your IRA, that's pretty easy. But then everybody gets deductions. You can either itemize, and if your itemized deductions are higher than the standard deduction, you'll itemize. But for most people, the standard deduction is higher than their itemized deduction. So that's your adjusted gross income after deductions. Modified adjusted gross income, to Dennis's point, is there's some add backs, and I don't know specifically what they are. Dennis, I don't know if you're someone that prepares your own tax return or not, if those things are, you know, if you use Quicken or QuickBook or TurboTax or, you know, one of those tools to do your own taxes. I don't know if those things are factored in there or not, but it's a great question. But again, the devil's in the details. I understand this from 10,000 feet, but I don't know that I fully understand all the idiosyncrasies. Peg, I'm going to give you the last word, and then I also want to remind Susie and you that I haven't forgotten that we promised we were going to get to a question from Sue, a text question, after the break. So final thoughts on Dennis's question, Peg, and then we can go to Sue's question.
Yeah, I just think it's impossible to, if you don't run a mock tax return, to figure out what's going to ripple, or, you know, use your financial advisor to help you. That's my two cents.
And then Sue's question was about, what if you're single and you're looking at Roth conversion? I'm not sure, you know, what her emphasis or concern is, why it's greatly different whether you're married, filing jointly, or filing a single term, a single return when we're looking at Roth conversions.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, being a single person, you're just taxed, you know, a little bit harsher, and it makes it hard to say, oh, this sounds like a great idea, you know, to do a conversion. So if you got these IRAs that are tax deferred, and they've been tax deferred for a long time, and you want to try to get positioned, as I recommended, to have some tax deferred and some tax advantage like a Roth, it can be difficult to do because of when you look at how much you're going to have to prepay now to do it. So I don't want people to feel like they have to do a lot, right? Even $5,000, if that works out, or $10,000. Some people end up doing a very large Roth conversion because they don't feel like they need that money. And here's the big key. So if you do a Roth conversion, that Roth does not have a required minimum distribution. So with a regular IRA at 73, you have to start taking money out. Well, if you convert that IRA into a Roth IRA, you don't have that required minimum distribution. So that's a big motivation for people to try to get in that position before they have to start taking that income out. Bruce?
Peg, as you were answering, I had kind of an aha moment, and I'm not sure if this is what Sue's question really was, but she, you know, she mentioned single. the single also maybe mean no children? Because again, when we look at Roth conversions, legacy planning is a big part of that. If you have traditional IRAs or traditional 401ks, traditional tax deferred accounts with a tax lien on that, if you take the income while you're alive, you pay the taxes. But if you leave that to your children, they pay the taxes. The taxes are not going to go away. It's going to go with to the next generation. So when we look at Roth conversions, what a client's priorities are or goals and objectives are with regard to legacy planning, that can factor into the advice we give as to whether or not a conversion is going to make sense. Do you want to pay the taxes, or do you want to leave this asset to your kids and let them pay the taxes? But if you have no children, that part of the equation goes away, and it actually simplifies it a little bit. The other thing I thought of, and I don't think this is where Sue was going with this, but sometimes, Peg, people also get confused between conversions versus new dollar contributions. So what you can actually put into an IRA or to a Roth IRA in terms of new dollar contributions in 2025, I think it was $7,500, that's different than a conversion. Some people might be going, what do you mean you're going to put $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 in your convert from your IRA to your Roth? Conversion of an existing IRA is different than contributing new dollars to an IRA. So there's limits on how much you can put, you can contribute. And again, as you said earlier in the first half of the show, Peg, if you make too much money, they phase out Roth completely. You're not able to contribute to a Roth. But where I was going with this is sometimes people are married and one person doesn't live outside the home. They can still contribute to an IRA or a Roth IRA if you have if you're married and you filed jointly. You don't have to have earned income of your own if your spouse has earned income. So both partners in the marriage can contribute, but obviously if you're single, again, that doesn't factor into the equation at all. Any other thoughts, Peg, before we go to another question?
No, I think we go to the next question.
All right, 651-461-9226. I'll just get this next one. Good show. Does wealth enhancement require a mandatory central review for all clients?
Peg, mandatory central review. I have a sneaking suspicion I know who wrote this.
Oh.
We get variations of this question a lot.
Okay.
We talk a lot about our round table, and we talk about a lot about how clients go through a round table process where you're not limited just to the technical expertise, or in my case, lack of technical expertise of a single advisor. Other people have input or fingerprints or thoughts and ideas to share on a particular client. Talk a little bit, Peg, maybe about what we do or don't do, or how the roundtable works, or how we have a collaborative process that we go through at Wealth Enhancement.
Yeah, let's start with the reviews. So what we do, and I love the fact that, you know, computers today, we've got this software and we've got everybody in there and we know who to contact, and the bigger job for us is trying to spread everybody out over 12 months, right? And so what we do is we actually require a mandatory offer for a review. And I'm kind of shocked with a lot of people just say, oh, I'm good. Like, this year is a very good year. And, I don't think I need to take advantage of that. So we're disciplined and actually reporting wise, we have to put that check mark that we offered the review. And then we put in our notes, they didn't want a review this year. Maybe you talked a little bit on the phone and there wasn't a reason. But yes, everybody gets the offer. And then when it comes to the, the structure of Wealth Enhancement Group and the round table, I don't know that I could have done as good of a job. Well, actually, I do know that I could not have done as good of a job if I didn't have the round table people. And those are the specialists that are in all discipline of planning, like tax and estate planning and investment, you know, the investment recommendations and all of those things. One person couldn't possibly do it all. So 27 or 28 years ago when we started, that was probably the best concept ever because I didn't know everything about everything. And so building that roundtable and having those people to go to for the benefit of the clients. And I think probably the most misinterpreted part of doing our job is some people actually just like on the show, Peg and Bruce should know everything and every question on every, you know, radio show we do. No, we can't possibly there. I mean, just think about how wide the breadth is of all this planning we do. Mm. And so we have a huge round table that backs us up. That's my two cents, Bruce.
Yeah, well, I love what you said about, you know, the reviews and being proactive. And some clients say, you know, once a year is fine. Other clients say, I want to review every 6 months. But whatever we agree to when we establish the relationship, we have a tickler system. We're proactive. And I agree, Peg, I've had a lot of clients that I probably haven't seen in years, but it's not because I didn't ask them. We reach out and say, you want to review? And they say, thanks, but no thanks. But we at least offer that. And then to the round table and to the collaborative sharing culture, so it goes back to the infancy stages of the company, Peg. It even predates you. When the company had like eight total people, we could all sit at our conference at a table at our in our conference room, and I'd spring for pizza, and we did it every Wednesday, and we'd mm-hmm. bring cases in that we talked about and you know, bounce ideas off each other, and that tradition has continued. Now, obviously, as we've grown to be thousands of employees with hundreds of thousands of clients, we can't all sit in a conference room at a table and eat pizza anymore. But we still, with technology, we still have these formalized roundtable meetings. And part of that is teaching or training or coaching or mentoring other advisors. So not every client goes through that process, but I can tell you, I have probably right now, personally, for my team, around 600 clients. I don't think there's ever been a client where I haven't consulted somebody else, either my associate advisor on my team, another advisor in my Eden Prairie office, or a more formalized roundtable, or central planning, or one of our CPAs, or one of our attorneys. I don't think there's a single client that I haven't consulted somebody so that I'm not making a unilateral decision or giving unilateral advice without input or expertise from somebody else. Two heads are better than one. And by the same token, even though I have only 600 or so clients, I've had input or participated in or offered things for thousands of clients, other advisors' clients that I've chimed in on that they asked me my opinion. I've had input on literally thousands. So it is a very collaborative sharing culture where we all help each other, and at the end of the day, the net benefit, of course, is to the client. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter wonders, is it better to do a Roth conversion when the market is down?
Great question. Short answer is yes, but Peg, it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, but I do the happy dance. When the market goes down and people are doing Roth conversions, it's a great idea if we could all pick when that was going to be. And the reason it is because you're taking these dollars from that tax deferred. You've just lost, and I'm going to be dramatic here, you just lost 25% of the value inside that IRA that's tax deferred. And now you want to move it over to the Roth. Historically, the market has always, always, always recovered. So keep that in mind. Another thing that I do is, and I've done a lot, is dollar cost average into a Roth. So if you have $100,000, and I'm just making this up and being dramatic, but if you have $100,000 in this IRA and you want to get that to the Roth, well, you maybe over the next 12 months, take 1/12 of it and convert. And then if the market goes down, I'd suggest accelerating it and then putting it all in the Roth. So there's things you can do just to create some confidence with clients. Cause most people want to do Roth conversions. Then we have to put that layer of that tax, taxes on top of that. So it is a little bit complex, and I would suggest that people get help in trying to do it. Bruce?
Yeah, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but just in general terms, so who should consider a Roth conversion? Again, it's not this easy, but what we often say is if you're retired, so you're not earning a paycheck anymore, and maybe you haven't yet started to draw Social Security, that might be kind of the perfect time or the sweet spot because your taxable income might be lower than it was in the past and lower than it will be in the future when you start to draw Social Security. But another good time is after a market retraction. Now, who shouldn't do it? If you're really highly compensated and you're in a really high tax bracket and the stock market's at or near an all-time high, then you'd say, well, maybe now is not a good time. But again, there's exceptions to both of those rules. But the real sweet spot for Roth conversion in my mind, Peg, is recently retired, earnings are down, not drawing Social Security yet. And in that case, I might not care where the stock market is, but I look at if they're in a low bracket, how much of that bracket can we soak up with Roth conversion? Susie, let's get in at least one more.
This is a good one because a lot of us have parents that, this guy says, my 89-year-old father's decided to cash out on two of his investments, giving us each about $20,000. He says that he doesn't think it'll have tax implications. Is there a way as a child you can say to a parent, I get what you're trying to do, but it might actually upset the apple cart? And I'm paraphrasing, but that's kind of the essence of it.
Yeah, Peg, that actually might be counterproductive because selling the investment, if it's not in an IRA, they may be losing a step up in basis there. Talk about that if you could.
Yeah, let's just say it's a 3M stock and the 89-year-old bought it for a dollar and now it's worth $200 a share. If he would have just gifted that to the kids, then they would have kept that same basis, but they wouldn't have had to have any immediate capital gains. But here, if he did cash it in and it's $20,000 to each kid, $19,000 you can give without doing any kind of a tax return saying, hey, I gave this money to my kids. So $19,000, and that's for each person. So if there's a husband and wife, you could double that. Or if you're single and you want to do it over 2 years, you could do that too. Give half this year, half next year, Bruce.
Yeah, Susie, I know we're out of time.
We are indeed, but a lot of great questions. And if you did not get your questions asked, please write this number down, 888-6-ADVICE. Again, 888-6-ADVICE. Or you can email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. That's yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Make it a great week.